Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa. Buddhaṃ Dhammaṃ Sanghaṃ Namassāmi. Tonight will be the last talk that I'll be giving for some time until October, because we are just about to start our rainy season retreat for the year. This is a tradition that dates from the time of the Buddha. 3 months of the year, monks and nuns are supposed to spend the time in their monastery, paying more attention to meditation practice and to study, and not to go out so much into teaching and contact with the lay people so much, but to do our own practice, to turn inward. And so on the full moon of July, which is the 5th of July, we will be performing a ceremony formally to enter the rains and to dedicate ourselves for the next 3 months to our own meditation practice and study. And so we won't be coming to Dharmaloka to give talks. And at our monastery, Dharmasara Nuns Monastery at Gijiganup, we'll be having the first month in retreat without having people come for that month to offer dana. But if you'd like to support our retreat by offering food, you can do so by leaving food here on a Friday night, uncooked food and fruit and vegetables, and that will be brought up to the monastery to be used during the following week. And we're able to do this year, to have a proper retreat for the first month, because now there is someone at Nuns Monastery who's training to be a nun. And because she's there, it makes it possible for me to have time in seclusion. And on the full moon day of July, before we actually start our rains retreat, our trainee nun, our first trainee nun, will be taking the big step of shaving her head. She will still be following 8 precepts and wearing white, but this means that she's making a further commitment to the nun's training. The way that we organise the training at the nun's monastery is that whoever wants to come with the idea eventually of ordaining has to spend 2 years on 8 precepts before they can take or ask for the 10 precepts. The main difference between 8 precepts and 10 precepts is that if you become a 10 precept nun, then you have to be prepared to give up your worldly possessions and become fully dependent on the monastery and the lay community that supports the monastery for your sustenance, for the 4 requisites of food for the day, clothing to cover the body and protect it from the elements and from insects, shelter to protect also from the elements and from insects and animals, and medicine when you're sick. And so that's a very big step. And so we encourage people to take that kind of decision gradually. So when women come to train for the first 6 months, they keep the 8 precepts, which includes celibacy and not eating after 12, not wearing makeup and not wearing jewellery, and dressing in a very sober style, but they still have control over their own finances. For the first 6 months, they are basically getting used to the lifestyle in the monastery. And then if they wish to continue further, at that time they have the opportunity to express that in quite a direct way to the community that supports them and also to the community at large, that is by shaving their head. And that's what's going to happen with our first trainee on the full moon of July. So that's quite a significant event for the nuns' monastery, because it means that we've moved one step further along the path to having a fully established training monastery for nuns. And I'd like to talk about this very powerful expression of one's commitment to the training and commitment to enlightenment that this act signifies. And I invite you all to just contemplate for a moment how you would feel if you knew that your head was about to get shaved and that you were going to use that as a way of expressing your commitment to your own enlightenment. What would come up in your mind if you knew that that's what you had to do in order to stay on the path? Would you think, oh, well, you know, it's not so important that I stay on the path. It's more important that I keep my hair. Or you might think, what a stupid thing to have to do, which is what someone told me when many years ago I first thought about taking this step in my own life. Sometimes we think, oh, I wouldn't care if I had my hair or not. No problem at all. So it's just an interesting thing to contemplate. Of course, it's not necessary to do it if you want to continue to practice the Buddha's path. But it's an interesting thing to see, well, how attached am I to the hair that's growing on my head? And in fact, this is one of the points that I would like to speak around in this talk, because the form that monastics follow, the precepts, the rules that they live by, and the lifestyle that they follow, as set down by the Buddha, has a number of different purposes. One of them, of course, is to help us to train the mind. If you're going to give up something that you've been used to having as part of you for all your life, the hair on your head, using it to express different moods, different perceptions of yourself, different images of yourself, how we wear our hair is often quite significant in how we're feeling about ourselves, how much care we take about ourselves. If you've been used to identifying with your hair for all of your life, quite a bit of attachment comes up to it. And the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha himself described as the path of non-attachment. And so just identifying something as mundane, if you like, as the hair on the head, as a point of attachment, can be quite significant in just realizing how many other things that we take for granted that we're so attached to. We're attached to this body, not just the hair on the head, but to all the bits and pieces of it that we assume is me, we assume is mine, we assume is under our control. The hair on the head we can cut, we can colour, we can perm, we can do all sorts of things with it. But there are other parts of the body that don't follow our wishes so easily. If our liver doesn't work well, for example, or if we break a leg, or we become paralyzed, or any of those kinds of things which we don't have so much control over, but which we've been identifying with as part of who we are for all of our life. It can be quite a challenge to come to terms with that kind of attachment. Not only are we attached to these things, but we also often have great pride in them. We're very proud of our healthy head of hair, as though it's something that we've created, something that we've got some say in, something that we've produced. And yet the hair on our head grows, falls out, gets grey, does all sorts of things according to its own nature, and yet we can take a lot of pride in it. We can take pride in our height, or in our strength, or in our petiteness, the petite body that we have. We can take pride in all sorts of things which we don't even reflect on, don't even consider, is this really something that I've had any say in, that I've controlled, that is really who I am? The Buddha said we can take pride in our good health. And then when we get sick, we're astounded that this body, which we assumed was under our control and expressing maybe our goodness because it's so healthy. What happens to our pride then? Very often when people suffer a major illness, they're devastated because they think, I've been such a good person. How could I get this kind of illness? Or I've done all the right things. I've eaten well. I've exercised. I've lived a good life and I get sick. Our pride is affected by the fact that our body is following its own nature, that is, to break up, to be diseased, to lose its strength and its vitality. The Buddha said his dharma is a dharma for abolishing pride. We don't even know we're proud until something happens to us which challenges who we think we are. The Buddha said people delight in attachment. They get pleasure out of attachment. Attaching to things that they think they've got control over, that they think they own, that they think will be like that forever. And people take pleasure in pride, in having things to be proud of, things which they can feel good about, not understanding that those things are subject to change. They arise because of various causes and conditions. And when those causes and conditions change, that thing which we identify with such pride, that also can change overnight. The Buddha said we also take great pleasure in restlessness. Restlessness that is constantly going here and there, doing this and that, with our mind and with our body, trying to find that ultimate satisfaction, that peak experience, that perfect job, that perfect partner, that thing, that place that is going to make life whatever we want it to be. Not only do we do it, but we like to do it. We enjoy busyness. We enjoy activity. We think there's something wrong if nothing's happening. And yet the Dharma of the Buddha is for developing calm, for developing contentment, for being at ease when nothing is happening. the Buddha said, because we don't realize our own foolishness, we are living a life of unknowing. And we are fettered by our unknowing. We are bound by our unknowing. And it's not really that we don't know, it's that we know incorrectly. We know only half the truth. We only know a part of the picture. Part of the picture is that it is possible to enjoy many things in this life. It is possible to have pleasant experiences. And it's good that we have things that we can be proud of, that we can feel respect for ourselves when we think about something that we've done or something that we've accomplished. And it's right that we should expend energy and effort to try to accomplish those things, to make plans in our life, to do what needs to be done. But our wrong knowing of those things is our understanding or expectation that they are going to bring us permanent happiness, that once we get them, they're going to stay that way forever, and that the things which we attach to, that we're proud of, that we seek after, are ultimately under our control. The Buddha's teaching is to show us that none of this is accurate. None of it is the truth. Everything in existence is subject to change. The very thing that we take great delight in today can be the source of our misery tomorrow or next year, when it's faded, when it's old, when it's worn out, or when we have to have the same thing that we like today, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. We get sick of it. Our attitude to the things in our life also changes. Not only the things themselves, the mind that delights is always changing, always being subject to different influences, and always reacting differently according to those influences. So what we've got this year is what everyone's getting. Isn't it great? And then next year, it's what everyone had last year. And this is what we're getting this year. Just subject to influences, causes and conditions, the same thing is no longer bringing us delight. And so we are trying to develop the true picture of the things in our life, this body and this mind. And that's why the monastic practice and the monastic lifestyle is important. Because the life that monastics live is a reflection of this teaching. It's an expression of the truths that the Buddha was pointing to. It doesn't mean that monastics are perfect or enlightened and that they don't have a hard time realizing these truths in their own life, but it means that the lifestyle itself is continually pointing towards these truths and supporting us on the path to the realization of these truths. That's why a significant step on the path, taking the training, is to be willing to shave one's head. Very attached to the hair, very attached to the way it looks, to the way I look with my hair. Proud of my hair. Happy that I've got hair like this. Having hair like this makes it easy for me to engage in the world, in the group that I want to be with, in the career that I want to be in, the things that I like to do, to go after the things that I'm interested in. And so when we come to turning away from worldly things, worldly pleasure, this is one of the signs that we make, that we're no longer playing in that kind of field. We're no longer giving primary importance to our physical appearance. We're no longer taking pride in how well we can present ourselves in the world. And as we take the step to do that, we reflect. One of the reasons why we're willing to do this is because we have confidence in the truth of the teaching. Another reason might be that we've had enough suffering in our life to think that it's worth taking this big step. And in order to continue the training and to continue walking the path, both of those things have to become points of reference for us, to continue building the faith in the teaching, in the teacher's enlightenment, in the fact that we too can become enlightened. And to constantly keep on examining where our suffering arises. You don't leave your suffering behind when you ordain. Whatever you've had is there with you, and all sorts of new suffering that you never imagined once you take this kind of step. But everyone has suffering. If you stay as a lay person, you have suffering. It's not that you can get out of it altogether just by making this choice. But you have to keep reminding yourself of that, because very often you might think that what you have to give up in order to live this life is too much. Is it worth it? And that's why you have to keep reminding yourself, yes, it is worth it, because the end of the path is complete freedom from suffering, is enlightenment. And so everyone who is practicing has to keep these two aspects in their mind. Where does my suffering really arise? And also, what does this path offer? What is the fruit of this path? Because if you don't keep asking yourself those questions, there will be many times when you think it's too difficult. I can't be bothered. People come and tell me all sorts of difficulties they're having in their life, but they also tell me about the difficulties that they're having meditating, for example. People have tried time and time again to learn to meditate, and they just can't do it. That means they just can't do it yet, in the sense of having peaceful meditations. But the meditation doesn't become peaceful until you keep at it long enough. Everyone has trouble, everyone has difficulty, everyone has hurdles to overcome. Just having a mind, just having a body. And so it's important to keep reminding oneself, this is the practice that the Buddha did, and he became enlightened. This is the practice that the Arahats did, and they became enlightened. This is the practice which people around me are doing now, and I can see the benefits that they have in their own life. And also, even though this is suffering, this is the way out of suffering. This difficult meditation, this training the mind, this is the way out of suffering. So those things have to be present even as we start the path and as we try to continue to develop, so that eventually we will come to the point where we enjoy sitting down to meditate, where it does become a tremendous support for our mind in the meditation itself and also in our daily life. So getting back to the fact of the shaving of the head, this is an act of renunciation. And in order to walk this path, we have to be prepared to renounce. We have to be prepared to give up our old habits, our old viewpoints. We have to be prepared to give up some of the things which we've previously depended on for our happiness, for our pleasure. If we keep the five precepts, we have to be willing to give up wrong speech, white lies, porky pies, as someone tells me they call their lies. They're only porky pies. That's a white lie. We have to be willing to give those up. We have to be willing to give up using drugs and alcohol so that we can uncover the peace within our own heart. So this again takes faith. It takes that reflection. Where does my true happiness lies? Temporary happiness in the drug or the alcohol. Temporary relief if I tell this lie. But what happens as a consequence? Where does it lead me? Does it lead me to happiness or does it lead me to more suffering? Remembering that the path of practice is the suffering that leads out of suffering. When we went to India to visit the places where the Buddha had practiced and where the Buddha lived, we went to a place called Vulture's Peak. And this was one of the Buddha's favourite places to go for meditation. And when we went there, it was a very powerful place to sit in meditation and to do some chanting, because the Buddha went there very often with his close disciples and stayed there for days at a time in meditation. The interesting thing about Vulture's Peak is that there's nothing there. It's empty. It's rocks, it's hills, it's low growth of trees. But there's nothing there. There's no temple there. There's no thing there that says, this is where an important person meditated. This is where a powerful person liked to spend his time. This is a really holy spot. And when you go there, it makes you reflect. This is the kind of place that the Buddha chose to spend a lot of time. In that emptiness. In that place where there was nothing to show what an important person he was, what a powerful teacher he was. This place was just outside one of the biggest cities, one of the most prosperous cities of the time. King Bimbisara, who was the king, was the same age as the Buddha and was a great devoted supporter of the Buddha and had offered the Buddha the first monastery that had ever been offered to the Buddha after his enlightenment. And King Bimbisara wanted to give the Buddha every kind of luxury, every kind of accompaniment that such a powerful teacher should have. And so in the monastery that was offered, that was down in the town, you can imagine that every kind of facility was available for the Buddha. But the Buddha chose to move out of the town and go and stay on the Vulture's Peak, where there were just rocks and caves and none of the comforts that were available in the monastery in the town. And it wasn't because he had to practice. He couldn't be with those comforts because they'd be a distraction or a temptation. He was already enlightened. And so what we see when we go to Vulture's Peak is the kind of place where an enlightened mind finds happiness, enjoys and delights in, empty places, places with no show, places that don't point to who this person is and how powerful they are. And as we went there and spent time in meditation and reflected on the kind of place it was a very powerful teaching that this is where we're heading in our practice. This is where the enlightened mind finds delight in emptiness, in simplicity. Choosing simplicity rather than choosing complexity, rather than choosing comfort, rather than choosing signs of power. And so in our practice, we can keep asking ourselves, is my mind becoming more simple? Is my life becoming more simple? Is my lifestyle becoming more simple or more complex as I walk this path? If we're practicing well, then we find that what we want is more space, and what we have is more spaciousness in the mind. We don't want busyness, we want emptiness. We don't want restlessness, we want stillness. This is a very important realization that we all have to make. The path that we're treading is not the path towards more, accumulating more, getting more, being bigger. It's towards letting go, and letting go. I was talking to someone today who is just recovering from cancer, and she was telling me that that's the thing that she had discovered most in her struggle with cancer. She'd had cancer twice over a number of years, different kinds of cancer. And she said the first time she had used her meditation to really help her to strengthen the mind and deal with what she was facing. But she forgot some of those lessons when she got well again. And although she'd simplified her life because she was totally absorbed in dealing with the cancer, once she got well again, she started to let all sorts of other things come in and complicate her life again. Distractions, interesting things, exciting things. And she lost the peace and the centre, the centeredness that she developed while she was really focusing on healing with her cancer. And so she got cancer again. And in that situation, she saw just how much she'd accumulated in the time between the first cancer and the second. Not only that she'd accumulated physically or materially, but how many things she was hanging on to in her mind once again, how much busyness there was. And so she realized she had to put some of those things down. And she put down and put down and put down, and then again experienced what she'd experienced previously, how good it felt, how light it felt, how much more peaceful it was to be letting go. And because she was faced with a life and death situation, she really had to let go of some of the things which she thought she couldn't do without. Bad habits, changes in her lifestyle, changes in her temperament, changes in the way she approached things, because she could see that they were things which were harming her. And so she let go and let go, and now she's well again. It doesn't always happen in that way. Sometimes we have an illness and we change our attitudes and we do all of the right things and we don't recover. So even that isn't a guarantee, because ultimately this body will change until it passes right away, even if we're doing all the right things. So it's not a matter of right and wrong, success and failure. If we can start to just let go, even if we don't recover, we've done something good for our well-being, for our peace of mind. But coming to the understanding that the Buddha's path is about letting go is a fundamental understanding that we all need to make if we're going to progress on the path to the end of all suffering. The Buddha said that one of the reasons for creating the monastic order is to encourage faith in those who have no faith in the teaching, and also to help to grow the faith of those who already have confidence in the teaching. So our monastic life is, if you like, a living example of the teaching that the Buddha has given. And the way that the Buddha established the monastic form and the kind of rules that we follow voluntarily are there not only to support us, but also to express, as I said, the truth of the teaching, to whatever extent we can do that individually in our own life as monks and nuns. And as you see someone willing to take the step, the next step of shaving their head and turning more and more away from the worldly life, then I hope that it causes you to reflect on the step that this person is taking, the commitment that they're showing, and also to reflect, where is my commitment to my own liberation? Where is my level of faith in the Buddha's teaching? And what can I do in my own life as a lay person to express the truth of the teaching, which I've glimpsed, maybe not, I haven't seen it completely, but which I've glimpsed, but which I still haven't been able to embrace completely? What can I give up? What can I see through where I was having the wrong view about things which I thought were mine, which I thought was who I am? Where can I let go of the things which are binding me to the wheel of birth and death? This is a reflection that we all need to make, and I hope just the fact that we have a very healthy and active monastic community here in Perth encourages all of you to reflect, why is it that the Buddha set up the Sangha? What does it point to in terms of the truth of the teaching? And what does it point to in terms of how I need to be developing in my own practice and in my own quest for enlightenment? So that's all I'd like to say. If anyone has any questions that they'd like to ask, then I would be very happy to try to answer them. The question is, what's the difference between letting go and dropping your bundle? And dropping your bundle means that you're doing it whether you like it or not. And it really, in the way that I understand that phrase, means that you're losing your centeredness, you're losing your equanimity, you're losing any sense of knowing really what's going on. And letting go, on the other hand, is quite a deliberate, active process. It's done with awareness, but that awareness is cultivated over time. And the letting go that happens in a moment of insight, of understanding at a deep level, or a moment of peace that comes in the mind, is not necessarily conscious at that moment, this is what I'm letting go of. Very often the work that we've done in order to let go of an attachment is happening up to that point, and the letting go is the end of a process. The actual work of letting go has happened prior to the letting go itself. And when that letting go happens, you're not even aware, sometimes, of all the work, all the many things you've done to reach that point, and then it just happens. So it's conscious, but it may not be conscious in the moment that it happens, just what it is that's happening until afterwards. You realise, for example, maybe, now someone was giving me the example of now that they started meditating, and in the mornings previously, whenever they would meet their youngest daughter, within 5 minutes at the breakfast table they'd be arguing. And she told me that this is just the pattern that they developed, that they couldn't sit down for breakfast without getting into an argument. And now since she's been meditating, she's become much more calm and also more aware of how she's getting agitated just at the anticipation of her daughter coming out and just at the anticipation that there might be an argument. So little by little she's been able to tune in to her own habit patterns. Just the thought of sitting down to breakfast with the daughter brings up a feeling of agitation. She didn't know that before. She didn't realise the agitation was already there even before her daughter walked in. And so together with the peacefulness from the meditation, there's the understanding of what's happening in the process. So now she's spent some time being able to just watch that agitation, watch the agitation, and to be more guarded about speaking to the daughter and getting involved in any kind of argument over little things, which would often happen. Before they knew it, it got to be big things. So process, process, process. Peacefulness, starting to understand the process, starting to be able to stand back from it and observe it, not get pushed along by the old habits. And she said, now, when the daughter comes down, they don't argue over breakfast. And it happened sort of one morning when she realised they were halfway through breakfast and they hadn't argued yet. And at that point, she realised some change has happened. That was, she'd been letting go of her old habit patterns, of her wrong understanding, little by little by little. And then in that moment, there was a letting go of a whole lot of accumulated irritation about that whole breakfast scene. She could almost laugh at herself as she realised things had changed and she hadn't even noticed it really. So that is letting go. Dropping your bundle is when you lose any kind of centeredness, any kind of sense of control over your own emotions or control over a situation. You're forced into a position which is a very uncomfortable one. And it may be that you drop your bundle in a very severe way and become completely overwhelmed by your emotions. Or it may just be that your emotions make it very difficult for you to think clearly. And so you can't make a lucid sort of, don't have a lucid state of mind in which to make a good judgment about a situation. And then afterwards you realise you've lost it. So they're the difference between, as I understand it, between dropping your bundle and letting go. The first precept, the first guideline is not to harm living beings. And the second one is to not to take what is not given. The Third one is to refrain from sexual misconduct, which means to refrain from adultery, to interfering in established relationships. The fourth one is to refrain from wrong speech, which is not only dishonest speech, but also harsh speech, speech which is tale-bearing and divides people. And then the last one is to refrain from using drugs and alcohol. One of the things that can happen too, which I think is important for us to appreciate, is that we can be making progress without even knowing it. Just as this person was practicing and thinking, oh, I'm still not able to sit really well in meditation. But that doesn't matter. It was having an effect on her whole relationship with herself, with her knowing her own mind, and also with her family. And yet she wasn't really appreciating it because her meditation wasn't blissful. So very often we're making progress and we're not aware of the changes that are happening because they're so subtle. And yet they are happening. And it's only if we stop practicing that we realise what we've given up. Sometimes we can think, oh, it's no point, I can't be bothered. It's only later that we realise, oh, I felt so much better when I was making the effort to keep the precepts, to be careful of how I speak, to do a little bit of meditation. It's only afterwards. So we have to also make sure that we take the time to appreciate the work that we're doing and to appreciate the benefits that we're getting. Otherwise, we can be discouraged and give up something which is very beneficial for ourselves and also for the people that we're living with. The question is, can you let go of something, give it up without substituting something else? This is a very good question because it's very difficult to give up something which is particularly satisfying for us. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a pleasant thing. We might get a lot of satisfaction out of having a good argument, and the argument itself is an unpleasant experience. But we can't give it up because we enjoy the what we get out of it, whether we get our way or just our power over winning. So it's not even that it's our attachments are always to pleasant things. So it is very difficult to give up something that we're getting a payoff from without replacing it with something else. And in the practice, the practice is to substitute something wholesome for an unwholesome thought. Particularly in the meditation, when you notice that you're dwelling in anger, for example, that you substitute thoughts of loving kindness. If you can't substitute thoughts of loving kindness towards the person that you're angry with, give them to yourself because you realise that you're hurting yourself by having so much anger. So in the meditation, that's where we practice substituting the wholesome for the unwholesome. But as we go further in our life, in practical terms, for example, if you've got a bad habit, then you have to put something else in the mental space and in the physical space in your life that bad habit occupies. So if you want to give up smoking, you often have to start chewing gum. Someone came to the nuns' monastery just recently who was trying to give up smoking, and we have a non-smoking policy at the nuns' monastery. And so he was chewing on gum the whole time because he was trying to refrain from taking a cigarette. But it was interesting because we gave him some lollies to chew and all that sort of thing so that he could put his gum down. But after he'd been there for a while and was feeling more relaxed, he said, you know, I've I don't feel stressed now. I don't need a cigarette. This place has really helped me to put down my stress. Now, that kind of experience, no one would have been able to convince him of if he hadn't come there, made the effort to come and spend some time in the forest and feel more relaxed. So sometimes we again are having to take steps which we don't have a guarantee are going to work until we do them. We have to do them on faith. And so this is was an example of where, not knowing that he was deliberately substituting a peaceful experience with the stress that he was feeling, helped him to temporarily overcome that habit. So we have to be aware of that. We have to put something in there. If we eat too much, for example, then we have to put something else in the place of the time and the situation that we are continually eating too much. So we have to get up and change our habits so we don't sit at the table too long, or we don't always be around the kitchen at that time. So yes, we have to. But in the practice, one of the things that we substitute is that we substitute wisdom for ignorance. And when we understand cause and effect and what creates suffering in our life, it's not that we have to substitute a thing to help us overcome our habit. It's that we have to bring up our understanding of the teaching. It's that we have to bring up our realization of where our true happiness lies. And in that way, we are not putting something material in the place of what was causing us suffering. We are putting our own understanding, our own wisdom. And that means it's really easy because you're carrying that with you everywhere. You don't have to go and find a lolly to eat or a place to go to. You're carrying it in your heart. But it requires a lot of mindfulness, and it requires commitment to practice so that you develop sufficient wisdom and strength of wisdom to be able to bring that up when you need it. So Roland's saying he's had a lot of episodes of illness in his life, and when he's well, he really enjoys it. Is there anything wrong with that? No, that's not. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, this is what we have to do. We appreciate what we've got. When we're sick, we really appreciate being healthy. Until we get sick, we very often take our health for granted. And so to appreciate it and to enjoy it when we have it is a very important support for developing contentment in our life, starting to appreciate what we've got rather than always looking for what's missing. So being happy when the body's working, that's fine. But to assume that it's going to be like that forever, or that it's because of me that it's happened, that's where we get caught in the wrong knowing. So the right knowing is, yes, to appreciate what we've got and enjoy it while we've got it, but not to assume that it's going to be there forever or that it's my personal property. The Buddha's teaching isn't about being miserable and saying, you know, oh, well, it's all suffering. It's not all suffering. Obviously, there are moments of pleasure. There are moments of happiness, many, many. And we appreciate them and we have gratitude for them. And this helps us, as I said, to develop contentment. Instead of always looking for what's missing, we recognize and happy with what's present in our life. But with understanding, if we understand that what we've got is precious because it can change at any moment, then we're going to make much better use of it. We're going to appreciate the people we have around us. Someone came recently who has very poor vision. They have a condition where their eyesight is deteriorating very, very rapidly. And you can imagine how much they appreciate just being able to see. And yet we take it for granted. We don't think twice the fact that we can open our eyes after the meditation and see what's in front of us. But just to appreciate how precious these things are brings up tremendous joy and gratitude in our life. That's the sort of buoyancy that we need in order to keep doing the work of purifying the mind. I think that's probably enough for now. So just again to reiterate what's happening at the Nuns Monastery, for those of you who usually come to support the monastery, from the 5th of July till the 5th of August, there will be no visitors, but you can leave food, uncooked food and fresh fruit and vegetables here, and on a Friday night, just put them by the nun's seat, and they'll be collected and brought up to the Nuns Monastery and will be used in the following week. And on the 5th of July, we'll be having a small ceremony for our entry to the reins and also for the head shaving of our first trainee. So any of you who have a connection with the Nuns Monastery are welcome to come for that. That will be in the afternoon, a Thursday afternoon, from 2 o'clock until 5 o'clock. There'll be some chanting and some meditation and the ceremony for the taking of the precepts. So apart from that, I've been asked also to just bring your attention to something which is has been initiated by the committee of the Buddhist Society. It's a questionnaire to gather your opinions on the suitability of Friday night as for the Dharma teaching which we which you've been receiving tonight. The program, which as most of you would be aware, happens every Friday night with a meditation and a Dharma talk. There has been some input from members of the society who feel that perhaps Friday night isn't the best night for people, and that maybe Saturday or another day, another time on the weekend, might be better. And so what we're doing is we're gathering information from those of you who come, and a questionnaire has been prepared and will be distributed this evening and over the next couple of weeks, so that you all have the opportunity to express what you think about this, whether it's Friday night is the best night, and whether the format for the weekend is also the one that is best. Keeping in mind that because the number of Sangha members who come to teach or who are able to teach is quite small, that it's not possible to extend the program that we presently offer, and that it does make it... it limits in a sense what can be offered as an alternative, but we would like to hear your reactions to the idea of changing to another time, to another night. James, who's the president, will perhaps add something to that when he makes the announcements now.